I should note, as you probably have observed, Justice Stacy is recused in this matter. Is it Ms. Burkholder? Good morning to you. You may approach.
You may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Sherry Burkholder. I represent the appellant, Stephanie Reimnitz. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. John and Stephanie Reimnitz were married for nearly 24 years. Stephanie gave up her career as a teacher to stay home with the party's 3 children early in their marriage. She later returned to work part-time. John filed for divorce in January 2012. He was represented by an attorney. In the divorce, Stephanie was not represented by an attorney. In January of 2012, also, the parties signed a property settlement agreement. A decree was entered on April 4th, 2012, and at the hearing, John testified that his income, as set forth in the child support calculation, was $120,000 per year, when his income was actually $147,300. He also testified that the property settlement agreement...
What is the basis for your saying that it was $147,000 a year?
The exhibit offered and received by the trial court from his employer, Gallup, stated that his gross income as of April 2012, his gross annual income was $147,000.
So is this an argument between gross and net?
The Nebraska Child Support Guidelines require that the gross income from all sources be used on the child support calculation. And that is what was offered and received and testified to as John as his gross annual
income. Well, you got an increase in the child support, didn't you?
Yes. Okay. Judge Merritt agreed.
Do you claim that
that
voids the settlement agreement that was approved in the divorce decree?
Yes, Your Honor. Under Zur v. Zur, the court found in Zur v. Zur under almost identical facts that when the trial court determined that the husband's income was higher
But the trial court in Zur didn't approve the settlement, did it?
No, Your Honor. The court approved the settlement in Zur, but they did not approve the child support calculation.
Excuse me, but was this the child support? Was there a separate child support modification in addition to what was that a new trial? How did the child support modification come up?
In September 2012, within the term of the court, within 6 months and within the term of the entry of the decree, which was entered on April 4th, 2012, Stephanie filed a motion or a complaint to vacate or modify the decree under Statute 25-2001. And during that time period, the court had virtually unlimited power
And part of the modification was the child support.
Yes, that was part of what was wrong with the property settlement agreement, yes.
Did you accept any of the benefits of the property settlement agreement before you brought this action to revoke it?
No, actually, the record reflects that the equity payment based upon the party's debts and assets at the time, Stephanie actually refused to accept it pending the outcome of this litigation.
What do you make of the colloquy that occurred between the judge and Stephanie at the hearing for approval of the settlement agreement? In other words, it seems to me the judge goes through quite a detailed, you understand what you're doing, you don't have a lawyer, you had an opportunity, you feel there's a need to do that, all those sorts of questions that seem to suggest that she made a knowing, intelligent choice to proceed in the way that she proceeded. How do we derive gross inequity from that?
Well, Your Honor, we're all presuming that John's testimony at that hearing was accurate, and it wasn't. John testified that the property settlement agreement was fair and reasonable when he received 79% of the net tax-affected marital estate, and Stephanie, after 21 years of marriage,
how do you compute the net percentages? Is that based upon the difference in the opinion of the Gallup stock?
No, Your Honor. Actually, if you look at John's exhibits that he offered, yes, the 21% is in part based upon the difference in the Gallup stock. But if you also look at John's exhibits that he offered, 50 through 54, where he gives himself the stale valuation of the Gallup stock that benefits him, he also gives himself approximately $150,000 in estimated future college and wedding expenses that he may or may not pay and counts them as marital debts on his side.
Didn't he agree to make those payments as part of the settlement agreement?
He did agree to make
them. And he wouldn't have had to make those.
That's right.
If you had a divorce decree.
If we had that issue before the court.
But that was known to your client at the time of the settlement agreement, wasn't it?
It was, but those figures are not marital debts under the law of the state of Nebraska. In Davidson v. Davidson, the court says that a marital debt is a debt that exists at the time of separation, and it was incurred already for the joint benefit of the parties.
Is it a mischaracterization in the settlement agreement that you're addressing? I mean, is it a bargained-for thing in an agreement, regardless of how it's characterized?
It could be, but this also goes to whether or not the agreement was unconscionable, and this court has said.
Isn't the total picture of this case dependent upon what value of the stock was determined at the time of the settlement agreement?
And that value
was $624 per share versus what you now claim is $824 a share.
Actually, no, Your Honor, because if you look at John's exhibits that he offered, he used his stale valuation of $674 a share, and he still could not get the number to 33 1/3%. With him giving himself credit for expenses that he was not probably going to ever incur for the children, which is not a marital debt, of $140,000-$150,000, and the stale valuation, he still comes up with 26 to 30%, even using numbers that aren't appropriate under the law. And so no matter how you calculate the marital estate, the agreement is unconscionable.
Your client received a decree that had that determination, that approved the agreement that she'd entered into and that she'd been queried very thoroughly by the trial judge about. She didn't appeal from that. Why should she now get another bite at the unconscionability issue?
Because she didn't understand what she received. She was not represented by an attorney. She trusted that John was going to be fair to her, and John wasn't fair to her. He took 79% of the marital estate. And this court has stated over and over and over again that a property settlement agreement for the how we determine whether it's conscionable is whether the spouse receives 33 1/3% to 50%.
So that's a bright line rule that if ultimately the spouse gets less than 33%, the settlement and the divorce decree are void as a matter of law?
In cases, this court has stated in Sullivan v. Sullivan that Polestar rule is especially important in long-term marriages of 24 years or more, and where a spouse has given up career and made contributions to the marriage, and all the children are children of the parties.
And you're saying that the parties to this cannot agree to take less than that?
I believe that if... Yes, I do. I believe that they cannot.
So no settlement agreement is valid if the one spouse received less than 33%.
I would say the settlement agreement when one spouse receives 21%.
Well, I'm just saying what you're advocating is that all settlements must transfer to the spouse at least 33% of the marital property.
Your Honor, I think that the court has stated that it's not a strict mathematical formula, but the rule that's the court wants everyone to be able to rely upon is 33 1/3 to 50%. And given the facts and circumstances of this case, I believe that that's particularly important.
Is this a presumption of 33%?
I think there is a presumption of 33 1/3%, yes, to make the case, to determine whether the property settlement agreement is conscionable, and then it's John's burden to show, well, in this case, that shouldn't apply, and why?
And how would that fit in if there's a premarital agreement that may or may not reflect the 33% portion?
I see that I've run out of time. May I answer your question?
You may.
Yes. In that particular case, a premarital agreement would define what's part of the marital estate and what's not part of the marital estate. There was no premarital agreement in this case. The parties were married a long time. Everything that the parties incurred was part of the marital estate. But in a premarital agreement, that would clearly define that those certain assets would not be part of the marital estate and would not be included in the 33%. Similar if you had, you know, long periods of separation or short-term marriage. There's a lot of facts that can factor into whether that 33 1/3, how strongly that applies. But in this case, the facts directly support that she should have received between 33 1/3 and 50%.
So at the time of this divorce hearing, the trial judge should have told her, no, I'm not going to go forward, even though you're not claiming this is unconscionable and you've chosen not to get an attorney. I'm not going to approve it until you go get an attorney and examine the agreement and examine your rights. Is that the sort of rule you're advocating for?
No, Your Honor. Had John accurately testified that Stephanie was only, that the agreement was not fair and it was not reasonable because Stephanie was only receiving 21% of the marital estate under the facts and circumstances of this case. Had John testified, no, my income is actually $147,300, Your Honor, but I want you to approve this child support calculation, I don't think that the court can say, because John failed to accurately testify to the facts of this case, the judge could have done anything different.
So this is a fraud on the court. Is that how you frame it?
That is part of the allegation. I don't think we have to get there because I think that the court has virtually unlimited authority to set aside a decree within the term when a property settlement agreement is
unconscionable. I think what Judge Castle's questions go to is when the trial court is presented with a settlement agreement, at what point does the judge, he or she, abuse his or her discretion?
In this case, my client filed a motion to vacate and presented evidence that enlightened the court on what the facts and circumstances were that the court did not know about at the hearing. And the court has unlimited authority to vacate when the circumstances are inequitable.
So you're forced to argue, are you not, that the judge abused his discretion in not reopening the property settlement?
Yes.
And that you understand abuse of discretion is a pretty high bar to reach.
It is, but the evidence is in the law strongly support.
And the bar here is 21 to 33. That's essentially what you're talking about, right?
The bar here is, yes, that she should have received a minimum of 33 1/3.
So going back to Judge Wright's question, these will remain open for as long as the settlement agreements aren't truly settled until the term expires and 6 months goes by, and maybe then. And then you're into equity revisions, so maybe not then yet.
May I answer?
Sure.
I understand your concern. I'm a family law attorney, and I think property settlement agreements are very important and crucial part of our practice. But I'm telling you that if a client in this circumstance is only receiving 21%, she's not even receiving the child support she's entitled to, that in those cases, we should be able to look back 6 months, and we should be able to correct an injustice.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Brown, good morning.
Actually, Mr. Bacon.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Bacon.
No problem.
Good morning.
May it please the court, my name is Joel Bacon. I represent John Reimnitz. I think it's important to emphasize at the beginning what this case is not about. It's not about fraud. It's not about deceit. My client didn't hide any assets. He did not force Stephanie to sign this agreement. Judge Merritt, at the trial on the motion to modify and vacate, specifically found all of that to be the case. That would be subject to an abuse of discretion standard that simply cannot be met here.
You're okay with Judge Merritt's including the $56,000 house of the husband as part of his assets, and also including the $50,000 note that he had against his pension plan asset too?
I think what Judge Merritt did at the hearing on the motion to modify was recognize that there were mathematical errors that were made in the original property settlement agreement.
So you're in agreement that the $50,000 note to the pension plan should also be considered an asset of the husband?
I think, if I understand Judge Merritt's math correctly, I think he said that that note was accidentally improperly reflected on the spreadsheet that the parties came up with, and he backed it out and came up with a mathematical formula.
Well, he's considering the note also as personal or as marital property of the husband, and also the value of the house in Council Bluffs as marital property, because he included those and then divided that basically by three and made that award to the wife. Isn't that right? Well, my point is you're not contesting that.
We've not appealed that, Your Honor.
Even so, I don't see how he got another $50,000 in there as a marital asset for the husband. You're not contesting that.
No, we're not.
What was the main bone of contention? Was it the value of the stock?
That was the main issue at the trial, Your Honor.
Does that make up the difference between 21% and whatever it might be?
There's a few other things, but that's the vast majority of it, Your Honor. And the
so
stock,
what is your position? What percentage are you arguing that the wife got?
We presented a series of different affidavits, depending on when you do the math, and the range, ends up being close to be 70 to 30. You know, one thing that's important to emphasize here, and I think this goes to some of the questions the court was asking earlier in regards to, if it's not 33, does that automatically mean it's not enforceable? Well, there's going to be other components of these types of settlement agreements. There's lots of things that are in play. There's custody issues. There's child support issues. And the courts have recognized there's give and take on all of those things. So one very important thing that happened in this case...
Well, really, is custody a fair issue in determining the division of the property?
Well, in a situation
That wouldn't be a fair reason to...
In a situation like this, Your Honor, I think what the parties agreed to was, John said, I'm not going to litigate joint physical custody with the understanding that I'm going to get... a greater portion of the estate.
Okay.
And I think it's important to note that's not something that we can go back and undo now. I mean, we're never going to be able to relitigate that issue of joint physical custody. That can't be undone. That bell's already been rung. So I do want to briefly hit on their argument with regards to the provision in the agreement that says if the agreement's not approved, then it becomes null and void. And I think where the court was going earlier on this is exactly correct. The approval that's talking about must necessarily be the approval that happened in front of Judge Nelson in this case at the consent hearing.
Well, at the modification, there wasn't any detriment to the wife. She, in fact, got more money plus attorney fees for that action on the modification.
That's exactly correct, Your Honor. And that also, they rely upon the Zerviezer case from the Court of Appeals. In that case, is the exact opposite of this. That the person who's appealing in that situation, and it's an appeal right from the initial decree.
A direct appeal from the decree.
Yeah, and that person who was appealing that was in my client's position. He was ordered to pay higher child support than what they'd agreed to. So it's a completely different situation than what we're doing.
Well, you also alleged that the wife has accepted the benefits of the settlement agreement and therefore cannot seek a modification subsequent to her acceptance of the benefits. What benefits are you talking about?
Well, I think that ties back into the custody question. Again, my client agreed that he would give up the opportunity to litigate joint physical custody with the understanding that he'd receive a greater share of the property.
Were there some other assets from the settlement that she converted to herself?
Yeah, he did make. He has made payments to her underneath the terms of the provision. He also has complied with the obligations with respect to paying for the debts of the adult or the liabilities of the adult children as well.
I realize Zer versus Zer says what it says, but why, as a matter of public policy or equity or the public concerns that go along with dissolution of marriage proceedings, should parties be allowed to bargain children and their incidents as if they were property. Shouldn't those issues, shouldn't the trial judge be able to say, I don't care what you do on children, you know, I'm going to treat the property issues separately, and your agreement on property is one thing, but when you try to argue, or you're in essence going to sell your rights to the custody of the children, I'm not going to let that go. Shouldn't that be the rule?
I think I can see a concern with that. I think even the statute recognizes that on the, there has to be a higher degree of scrutiny. There has to be, you know, we have to look to see what the best interest of the child's benefits are going to be. I think that it requires that. But there's also a component of that, that by allowing the parties to do that, we actually might facilitate avoiding hostile situations where now we're going to go into court. We're going to put the child at the focal point of this thing instead of trying to work out those types of things ahead of time.
Why was the stock correctly valued at the time when actually the report that came out showed that the value of the stock as of December 2011 was in fact $824 a share versus the $600 and some a share that was used in the property settlement?
Well, I think...
I mean, because that amount's based upon a 2010 determination of the stock. But the $824 is based on the 2011 determination of the stock, which is right prior to the time that the divorce decree was entered.
Right. The property settlement agreement, Your Honor, was signed at the end of January 2012.
Right.
That's when they sat down and said, okay, how are we going to divvy these things up? And they went through a whole process with that. And they both went online and they agreed to use that valuation.
But wasn't it really actually that value was incorrect? Because the actual value at that time really was $800.
Well, there would have been no way to know that the actual value of that was $824 at that time, because the report that they're relying upon, it's dated the same day as the consent hearing, August or April 4th. So they wouldn't have had that information.
Which shows that, but that report does show the value of the stock as of the end of 2011.
It does show that, although there's some language within the, you know, we're talking about restricted stock, that type of thing. Gallup's a closely held corporation, so... there is some language within the policies that says you're supposed to use the most recent available data, which would have been what they had in January of 2012. And I also think there's an assumption of a risk concept here, too. I mean, Stephanie, this wasn't their first rodeo. They went through this each year he worked there with the stock went up and down. She assumed the risk that new valuation was going to be higher. My client assumed the risk it was going to be lower. You know, if it had turned out to be lower, we wouldn't be, you know, she wouldn't be here complaining that this thing was unfair.
And there was expert testimony at the second hearing as to the value of the stock at the time of the settlement agreement.
Yes, Your Honor. I also just think, I think that's all subject to an abuse of discretion standard. You know, did Judge Rear have a basis for determining January 11th or January 31st was a reasonable time to value it? And he clearly did. And there's a rational basis for that. That was
the trial court had the right as a matter of law to modify the child support. Does the court have the right as a matter of law to modify child support payments if the child support payments aren't being correctly paid or haven't been correctly determined?
We're not appealing that issue, Your Honor. So, I mean, it's where we sit today procedurally. We don't have any issues with what judgment.
You're in agreement that you'll pay the extra child
support. Yes, Your Honor.
Have you done that?
I don't know, Your Honor. I'm not sure. I apologize for that. Unless there's any further questions, we ask that the decision of the district court be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. We will go on then to the last case of the day, which is Marshall versus iCare Specialties. Justice Wright is recused from this matter. Justice Stacy is recused from this matter. The court will be joined by Judges Irwin, Inbody, and Pirtle of the Court of Appeals.
Hello.